Yeah, it gets into, I mean, if we're going to go into like the dystopia and the various scenarios, I mean, that's certainly interesting and it's definitely relevant. I mean, AI automation, I think that one of the theories I've seen is that you have human, the biology, you will merge the automated AI machinery into some of the human biology, that's also a way to extract more, even more labor, because a machine alone is one thing, but a machine that has some biological components and it is even better in terms of the efficiency, and you can build, let's say, like there's a whole area of medicine that's a huge untapped market of like body alterations and a machine implants and these types of things.
Cable.
So,
Cable from X-Men.
yeah.
I
And you know, no, yeah,
don't know.
I haven't seen, I haven't seen.
It's whatever.
But I wanted to go back to say the Shining, because I think the Shining, as I watched the Shining, and sorry to bother you, I was really struck by the structure of the plot is the same, is similar. I hadn't remembered just how the Shining slowly builds, and the final act of the Shining is really when it all gets turned up to a whole nother level of insanity. You know, that the hotel comes alive only at the end. Before that, it's just like subtle hints, and it's not quite like the hotel becomes this own entity. Like you have the bear suit man, you have the blood spilling out, you have it just it, and it reminded me of the plot of Sorry to Bother You, because it's kind of this slow burn that then just explodes into a final act of like where your jaws basically drop. You're like, what the fuck, you know, what if just happened, you know? And so I thought the structure of how the films were made was similar, and you know, the economics of The Shining, that's talked about in Room 237. There's the whole theory about the gold. I don't, is that Room 237 or is that someone else online? But that it's about the Federal Reserve System, and that, yeah.
Well,
So like the gold room and the elites of The Shining that are kind of maybe the secret.
Rob Edger talks about that too, yeah.
Well, Dennis and I did that as I think the winter book, maybe it was last year, but maybe it was 2 years ago. But so that's what's interesting, SJ, is that Jack is kind of like, you know, they're worried about a rat getting into the Overlook, and you know, Dennis and I spoke about kind of like this manager class that kind of maintains the privileged. But you know, he discovers all the documents in the basement of the Overlook, and he realizes that he could bring the structure down, but you know, it drove him mad, you know, because he was imagining like he had everything he needed, and he thought, you know, it was a great piece of art that he could do it if he could just turn it into a novel and do this takedown. And so like in the movie you see he's got this giant scrapbook, and that's where, you know, it's detailing the different dignitaries that would come in and rent the whole, you know, bridal suites, you know, and have, you know, whole salmons ordered up and bathtubs of gin and blah blah blah.
Wow, I didn't realize there's a whole actual, that's part of the plot of the novel where you have documents that, okay, wow. You know, it's so funny you say that, because I feel like the Sorry to Bother You is like a work of art that shouldn't have been made, that got made because Boots Riley kind of, like, you know, are you guys familiar with what's happening with him right now on Twitter? I mean, he's
No.
basically gone off on the CIA and the whole Venezuela coup thing. Like, he's the people from the mainstream left, like, are he's in a war with them right now,
Oh,
because he's
really?
basically said, yeah, I'm against U.S. imperialism in
Yeah.
Syria and in Venezuela. And so it's kind of this weird world we're in politically, where you have like some people on the left that are anti-imperialistic and against American interventionism are being accused of like you're an Assad apologist or a Maduro apologist. by like more like a, let's say, mainstream democratic types that have signed on to some of this stuff, humanitarian intervention, that support humanitarian intervention. So, but Boots Riley is, I mean, I don't know what his career is going to be like. It feels like he just kind of snuck in and he made this movie. It's very subversive. I think it's an extremely subversive film. It challenges all of our assumptions about race, class, the structure of the system. Even the protagonist may have sold out at the end. I mean, that's how challenging this movie is. I don't know.
Well, funny because one of my first thoughts of the girlfriend rejecting him over his success and all of the money that he was getting, I thought that was like unrealistic. I was surprised that people would be rejecting that because of the power of that allure. Like, you know, do you know what I'm talking about, SJ? Like, did you find that at all surprising? Because
The fact that his girlfriend rejected him because he sold out, basically. Her character was such a true believer activist that maybe and Boots Riley and the Cash character became such a douche. Let's just be real. Yeah. I mean, he was just,
she's a good actress. I really like her. And, but also too, like, he even points out to her that the aspiration, and I thought that was actually kind of a nice insight into the art world in terms of like, you're just going to sell to really rich people. I don't know.
Yeah, no, for sure. This movie, it's kind of like we were saying that Ficcione, or why haven't we banned Voorhees? I mean, I'm concerned for Boots Riley's career. Let me just put it that way. I don't know if he's going to get another opportunity with the same backing and the same, like I think he's persona non grata from what I can tell. Just in the
that was sector. That was the nature of my question, and so okay. I'm just curious, there's a lot of good, you know, well-known actors in this. Does it have kind of like an experimental quality to it, or does it feel like a major released film, or like, you know,
pretty much, yeah,
because I would have thought that because it was so thought-provoking that it would have made some impact, you know, during award season.
Yeah, it was. I think it was turned off. I think Boots Riley's been turned off. No, my sense is it's one of those movies that it's clearly an art film through and through. Yeah. But it's sometimes these really well-done art movies get taken by money distributors and then they get sold to the masses. And this was clearly that. It's both. It's both a subversive art movie, and it was kind of packaged as this is going to be like a darling. I mean, it was in all the major theaters, and it had a massive release. That doesn't really happen, like, unless you've been greenlit and kind of chosen to be projected out by the distributors. So it's both, Doug. And yeah, I would think it would have had the awards. I mean, too, I was totally surprised that I didn't see it. It would have been this year's award season, like the last one we just went through. And Boots Riley is, I mean, I admire him a lot now. I mean, I admire, but just the idea of a work of art from that you can somehow get yourself into the system and then make a work of art that has this kind of power. That's really interesting to me too, as we talk about like methods of resistance, our conversation earlier, whether it's organizing labor or internal spiritual work. I think this is one other strategy, whereas if you can somehow, like the meme wars, you know, they talk about the meme wars, and Terrence McKenna was like, don't take culture, make it, and make the memes to propagate the memes. I feel like this is a resounding success. I mean, he's done a huge service here. That was a long way of derailing us, but back to The Shining, you were saying, you know, the political aspects of The Shining. I don't know. I feel like there was something else there that we because maybe it was the idea of like these off-planet entities that comes up in the, does that come up in the book, that there's spirits that are kind of part of this elite, these elite circles in the hotel?
But so like that in the book, it's both literally true and then figuratively true. Like, we're haunted by the past. We're haunted by, you know, these things that we can't see that actually control, you know, because, so that was the interesting thing when we did that book, was that both Danny and Wendy were trapped in this house that they had no control over. You know, they were just along for the ride with Jack. And so... I don't know. So there is this kind of both the literalness of those external controlling forces, and then the metaphorical aspect to it too.
Yeah, like the trauma of just, is it like a psychological thing where we have to confront our past, or we'll live on in the present? And these kind of like the psychology is unseen in a way. Like, I walk into a room, no one knows that I might be struggling with, you know, something that happened 5 years ago, you know?
Yeah.
It's an unseen driving force.
One of the Kardashians recently was just named by Forbes as the youngest self-made billionaire, right?
Oh my God. Kendall
Jenner, yeah. Or Kylie Jenner, yeah.
And so, but it's like, what, self-made how? What do you mean? Like,
she's a billionaire.
She is now, yeah.
Wow.
Makeup. She's got a whole makeup. She tapped into the fame to make a makeup line.
And, I didn't know that.
It's gone supernova. Mm-hmm. Wonder how much labor has gone into that. It's been exploited for those billions. I mean, the makeup industry is... I haven't studied that, but I imagine there's some factories and some sweatshops that are part of those billions.
I think the sweatshops are just unavoidable, probably in almost every industry. So it's interesting. A couple things rose to my mind, and one was thinking about Slavoj Žižek's idea about like ideology and how the kernel, the animating kernel, whatever it is always there. And during this time, I've been thinking about like satire and Saturday Night Live and what benefit they actually have, you know, as far as what their art is doing. So it's interesting because I think, I don't remember what podcast I was listening to, but someone was talking about how when you do like a really pointed satire, usually you split the crowd. And so the people that are in favor of the person you're satiring, there's this love-hate thing that happens, but no one actually wins. You're just making people more divided. You aren't creating any solutions. You're not bringing people together. You're dividing people by doing the kind of satire that Saturday Night Live does all the time. And so I started thinking about that like from an ideological standpoint. It's like, well, what are they after? And, you know, maybe it's just cultural credibility or, you know. So like that was an interesting thought that has arisen as far as... the animating feature, you know, as far as what is actually happening. But the other thing, this movie Cloud Atlas continually arises in my mind when we have a discussion like this, because it seems like in that movie there are these generational forces that are like people are trying to upend these firm structures that have been in place for so long, and it's just this ongoing fight. But there's like a hopefulness to that movie as far as making tiny little changes. There's a line in that movie though, the weaker meet and the rich do eat. Did you guys see that movie?
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, and I read the book too. Yeah, I read the book before I saw it and before it came out, and then I went to see it. It was one of those weird times where I don't even something came over me. I think it was the Wachowski siblings and my hope that they were gonna, you know, and I just. And then David, what's the guy's David Cross or the David?
David,
the
novel? David Mitchell. David Mitchell.
David Mitchell. David Mitchell. And so
they definitely have it. Yeah. I mean, like they took the source material. I read the book too. And there's a lot more detail in the book. But, you know, as far as the ideological point that the Wachowski brothers are, or I don't think we call them, the Wachowskis are trying to make, you know, they definitely are able to make their point. They do that all the time. They did it in The Matrix. They did it in even Jupiter Rising. Like, they are all about the class struggle for sure.
Yeah, I appreciate that about their work. And that one seems to be more. I remember thinking that it's about like the synchronicity across space and time. It kind of cycles of repetition. Yeah. And I thought that was a powerful, just theme that things can kind of aren't limited to one moment in space and time, you know. But just so I'm just trying to go back. So you were saying, Doug, that the Cloud Atlas, yeah, there's it's definitely a hopeful movie because like at the end, what is it, Tom Hanks is like sitting on that log and they look up or something and like they won the battle or something like that, and they're and Tom Hanks is it's like a caveman Tom Hanks that there's kind of a happy a happy ending. Is that it?
Well, there's even the like it seems like there's these big quotes that happen, but so like, do you ever feel like there's these forces or like there's just something that is preventing you, you know? So it's almost like there's so much momentum to this thing that's oppressing people, you know, symbolized kind of by these cannibals, you know, they're just riding around eating the villagers in the futuristic Hawaii.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, the whole movie, the people struggling under that oppression are just making little tiny incremental gains to win, you know, what amounts to their freedom. I mean, there's a lot of other stuff going on, too, because it does seem like there's, you know, these different tales are talking to, even though it's linear, at the same time, it also feels simultaneous.
Yes. The Cloud Atlas Sextet. Now I'm remembering. That was my favorite part of the whole thing. The composer who writes the music and kills himself in the book. I don't think he kills himself in the novel. I think he gets... I mean, sorry, in the movie, I think they took that part out. But art, you were talking about art, Doug, and art as a way to kind of get to some of this stuff. I think that's what you were saying about the Wachowskis and the film Cloud Atlas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's funny because you can reach the masses, but I don't know that. So, like, that's the interesting thing. You can reach the people that you need to, but... You know, you can't really change anything. You need the masses to, you know, shift the system so that you can actually affect a change.
Yeah, the Saturday Night Live stuff. That's what I was, okay, that's what you said. Then that's what I wanted to say something about was like, yeah, I mean, we're in this age, the meme, I'm going to call it the meme wars. And I use it in the way of like Terrence McKenna's use, even though I think the contemporary use of the term meme is applicable here too, because those are works of art. I mean, those are works of visual art, you know, and satire even. And I think that there's something about the efficacy and the velocity of how a satire or a work of art or a soundbite or a song or something like this can move through the system. It's like a virus. I mean, it gets in and it can move overnight. You can blow up like these MPC memes that ended up getting removed by Twitter. they blew up overnight, and that was a political, it had a political agenda. They were divisive, just like the Saturday Night Live version. I mean, it's certainly a political agenda written by design to kind of go after, to put into the body politic and the consciousness a certain viewpoint. And they're very good. I mean, they're very, the most talented actors and writers. And so I think what I was just going to say is that I do think the mechanism of art and satire and memery is very powerful on the one hand, but two, we always have to look at what's the agenda, because there is a set of ideas that are propagated always. I don't think there's a work of art that, you know, maybe, I don't know, maybe Dennis can speak to this, but it seems like there's always ideas behind something, especially, and there's a reason why it becomes popular or doesn't, or gets banned or doesn't. And I think that's just a key point, that like, what is being sold? Like, it might be funny, it might be awesome, but there's, I think people are going to react to it depending on what their beliefs are, you know, that they come to the exchange with. And that's why you see people on Saturday Night Live, I can't even watch it anymore.
I think that's where I'm at too, where you realize that they're willing to put anyone up on that stage. Like, it doesn't, so like they make fun of Sean Spicer for a year and then they have him as the host or something like that, right? It's like, so what are they selling? It's the spectacle, I think, or I don't know.
I mean, I think they're mainstream. I mean, they're certainly like a mainstream. In a, what is the term? Reality tunnels that Robert Anton Wilson. I mean, it's certainly a mainstream. It's a reality tunnel that's restricted, and that's, I think, is their ultimate product. It's like, let's keep people into the new, whatever's in the news cycle that's on like the corporate news at night. And I mean, they're not doing satire about like a David Icke lecture, you know, in a way that engages those ideas, you know. It's very much about the politics as it's presented. And I think that's a big part of the agenda, so-called, put it in, you know, of something like that, is to just keep the whatever's on the front pages and selling, just kind of keep that fresh and, you know. And Trump was on. Right. I mean, Trump was on, but during the election cycle, remember, they brought him in. It was like 2015. I mean, they were part of, and then he became the target. Like, so that's interesting, too. You mentioned the Sean Spicer, but Trump is kind of even maybe the best recent example of that. And they have that Alec Baldwin. Right. He's but they were playing both sides.
So. They play all the sides. That's exactly right. But then. Yeah. I think they make... There's kind of like this self-satisfaction that they generate in some people, and then maybe anger in others, but, you know, they still get viewers, and then they are able to, you know, sell ads to their advertisers.
Yeah. The satire from Sorry to Bother You is a great juxtaposition here, because that's if Saturday Night Live took the topics and started satirizing the topics that Boots Riley did, then I don't think they would be allowed on TV. And that's part of it for me, certainly.
Well, this is, sounds like such a great movie I made you guys watch, huh?
Yeah, I watched it twice. Well,
Alan said.
Yes, yeah. Alan. I'd love to hear what he thinks. Because didn't he say he either attended or was going to attend a lecture by Boots?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think he said something to that effect. I'd like to hear his thoughts.
Well, I think he's, I'd like to hear his thoughts, too.
Get him on the horn. You watch the movie, Doug, and then you telephone Alan and get it done.
Well, did you guys, how did you, So one of the reasons why I haven't seen this is I was kind of hoping that it was just going to migrate to one of these services that I have access to.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I hear you.
And so I was going to rent it, like pay to rent it. Yeah. But then the right night just kept escaping me because I just fall
Boise
asleep.
Boise doesn't have a public library, Doug? You don't take your kids to the library every week like me?
I do, Dennis. I do. But it's funny. I don't think of watching movies like on the couch anymore. It's all
I know.
In bed on some kind of screen that I'm holding with my hand.
Yeah. Well, I hear you there. But like, see, that's why I spend a lot of time drawing, so I will have something on the TV. I won't always be watching it like attentively, but it'll be on. Whereas I can't hold the device and watch it. I almost never do that. But
so it's funny. My wife, the dog, she actually puts her iPad on her drawing table.
Yeah.
Nice. You know, and so she's working on the piece to the right, and then to the left, she's got Grey's Anatomy going or whatever it is.
Right? Yeah, I hear you. Yeah. Yeah, my wife does that with processing images for photography on the computer. She'll have stuff she watches while doing that.
But like that's the kind of, so like you need kind of mindless soapy kind of dribble. Like it's interesting because depending on, I think because there's two senses involved, both the sight and the, so like podcasts are different, I think. I mean, so depending on how much concentration you're giving any one activity, you end up losing some. Yeah. And so usually...
This is why...
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, this is why I still am a huge component of in the theater. If something's in the theater, I try to see it before it leaves because you're forced to sit there. It's in the dark. You can't leave. You can leave, but you're going to miss it. But you can't say, all right, pause it. I need to go, you know. That's not part of the movie theater experience. And I know for me, being out of the United States and being in places where there's really not stuff available, I've been watching more on my tab. I've got a couple of these tablets. I always try to have a couple of screens available and a couple of phones. And it's just, but I've been turning all the lights down, treating it like it is a movie theater experience, trying to, you know, go to the bathroom before, get everything I'm going to need, and then sit down and just try to stay focused as if I'm in the theater.
Boy, SJ, can you imagine watching Sorry to Bother You in a theater, like engaging the rest of the audience's reaction to some of these topics? Like that's like, that would have been fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, it was to see how people, it's such a smart movie that I don't know, you know.
Yeah. Like, but I would love to hear Alan's thoughts on that too, because it sounds like he did see that in a group setting. But
Yeah.
It was fun. It was a fun movie.
I think it's a really important movie. I hope it becomes a cult classic. I mean, it should be. It should be like They Live or any of these conspiracy kind of classic type movies. It's right there. It's perfect for that. You know, I say conspiracy loosely, but just films that are about like the structure of society and power, and they kind of are telling truth in a way that maybe later we're going to look back when the hybrids actually do get released, you know, in 10 years or whenever, that this is had a, you know, predictive quality. Yeah, I recommend it, Doug, if you can get to it. I mean, it's. I think you'll really like it.
I've been wanting to get to it for a long time. Oh, maybe I should go the dentist route and just check it out from the library. Like,
there you go. It's right there for you.
But then you're saying, oh, you need to watch it multiple times. And so then it would be one of these things where... So I think like on Amazon, see, that's the other thing. What about all these fucking corporations in our life? like, when and how can we draw the line and say, it's like all these different, so something I learned, it's like, it's usually the middlemen that make the money somehow, which yeah. seems like it shouldn't be the case, but it is. Like the farmers, they're not making the money, you know, like they're getting hosed by the middlemen, and then the middlemen, they're like, well, we have to make money. You know, that's what they tell their customers. We have to market up because we have to stay in business. But it seems like, you know, it's your Amazons, or it's the people in the middle that are able to extract the wealth somehow. The other ones
and the
go ahead.
I was saying the government's often a big part of that, especially with Amazon. Like it raises this other point about monopolistic capitalism. If you want to even, I don't even like to use the term capitalism because I just think it's one that's kind of lost its meaning. But monopolistic, large scale, modern economic activity. Because Amazon's a great example in that. I don't know if it was in this lecture or another video I was just recently watching, but basically every Uber ride, you know, Amazon makes like 13 cents because it's all runs through the Amazon cloud services that are one of their huge
amazing.
Well,
and they have the CIA contract that he's like goes to the Pentagon now. There's pictures, he looks like a paramilitary soldier now, the CEO. He's like, he's clearly done like, you know, training. He's ripped. He's got like, he's at the Pentagon all the time. So I think
Are you talking about Bezos?
Yeah. Bezos. Yeah. Just type in Jeff Bezos ripped and like, just look at any, I mean, you can compare the pictures. He was like this nerd, you know, and he had like a balding hair, and now he's just this ripped. He looks, it's wild. I'm going to type it in now. See Jeff Bezos.
you know, hey, SJ, another story that Catherine Austin Fitz tells is of the patriarch of the Bechtel family, the arms manufacturers. Stephen Bechtel, I think was his name. And in the 50s, it was already such a profitable military contractor that he was advocating for private company ownership of nuclear weapons in the late 50s. And it's believed that part of what Eisenhower was, his famous speech against the military-industrial complex was in backlash to like the power of those military contractors already thinking that they should have like nuclear weapons and stuff like that. It's pretty nuts. So if you, I mean, like Amazon or Monsanto, like, I mean, Monsanto, that doesn't seem that far out of the question that they would, being that they, you know, previously developed military stuff anyways. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, all the big data companies, I mean, the military is right in there. I mean, it's really highly relevant. And I think it's a part of, like, Amazon, if you go to the movie, sorry to bother you, Amazon is kind of like worry-free in a way. I mean, I just saw that they're cutting the hours of the Whole Foods workers. Did you guys see this story?
Yeah,
this week?
They raised like, everyone's wages and then cut their hours.
Yeah. And they cut their hours.
Oh, no so, way. Really?
Yeah. And they got praise. It's like, yeah, Amazon finally doing the right thing. And Bernie did it. Bernie caused it. Yay. And then it's like you read the fine print and it's just like, no. I mean, it's like this Leviathan. It just marches on.
Does that
on.
Affect people's eligibility for health care? For their...
Quite likely. Like, if they're going from 20 to... right. 30 to 20 hours, you know, they might end up in, like, from a full-time to a half-time kind of...
Yeah, right? Oh, that's fucked.
But, so, that's what's so... Like, in my market, we can't compete with Whole Foods. They're paying... You know, they start people at like $15, $16, $17 an hour.
Yeah.
Which it's weird how the cost of living It's so like I've been thinking about San Francisco and how like mortals can't afford to live there anymore.
Nope. Yeah. I got an email from a friend who's an artist in San Francisco, and it was like, what's it like to move to a smaller mid-level city? I was like, you know, how do you even live there? How do you live in San Francisco? It became hard enough to live in LA.
That's why I left the country, guys. I mean, it's just, it's so cheap, you know, I mean, where I am. And I mean, that's my goal, is just kind of just live in cheaper places and try to gain some financial traction. You know, I mean, I don't have a family, so it's easier for me to do that. But, you know, it's a whole nother world when you leave, and the pressures of even Austin. Yeah. My town. I mean, I saw property go way up, rents go way up. I mean, you can't even rent a studio apartment anymore for the kind of wages that are available, you know? Yeah. And I'm assuming for me, I was resistant of like going into the corporate world. Did a lot of people just kind of bite the bullet and join a corporation and work 50, 60 hours, and then I guess you can afford things, but. Or have a wife, like dual income, that could probably help. But I think this is part of the pressure we're facing. And I'm glad we brought this up, because this is the other thing I wanted to talk about, like just the general economic stuff. You know, I know you brought this up, Doug, you were feeling like it was a necessary topic, but like the things like healthcare and just move it, like how are people surviving? It seems like people are less and less getting those basic needs met in America, at least. And there's a corrosive effect to the psyche of the nation. Wouldn't you say? I mean, I know there's the stress and people are sick. I mean, I see these stories all the time. Like you get people are can't get their medicine. Like there's people that were eating like half their diabetes medicine and then they died because they couldn't afford the medicine. I mean, it's just, there's a dehumanizing quality to the, and it's got to be in the air. I mean, I know I haven't been back. I'm going to be back in May, so I'm really curious to see for like a couple of weeks. I'm just curious to see how everybody's doing over there and like what the feeling is. But I know that, like where I am, it's like people, it's a college town. So you have all these college students, and then it's a government town. So you have all the government jobs, and you have college students who are getting, you know, loans from the government. So there's a certain stability. And then you have tech companies have come in. So you have that whole like echelon of the American society, like the tech jobs where people can afford the nicer apartments and things. But what else? I mean, it seems like there's a lot of people that have fallen through the cracks.
Yeah.
And,
but so like, that's the interesting thing about this conversation is that I used to blame myself like for my lack of financial savvy is what I thought, that I'm just really not very good. But I think that, and maybe this movie spells that out, sorry to bother you, that the system's designed to take advantage of people, like whether it's student loans or credit card debt or whatever, payday loans, whatever it is, like they're extracting value where they can from people that really can't stand up for themselves.
Yeah.
It's by design. Yeah. I mean, it's exploitative. Max Kaiser. Do you know this guy, Max Kaiser? He's a
sure.
I just was watching. I like to watch his show. So he's got like this 20-minute or 30-minute show on RT, and it comes out every few days online. And he's got, you know, it's not always great, but there's some of these shows are really great. And he was making a joke. He was like, if you go to the hospital, you go to the emergency room, and there's just, it's like there's ghouls. And he was talking about the doctors and nurses just waiting, and they're like, you know. Let's see, we can do this operation or do this operation. And they're just excited about these patients because of the money. And I'm not blaming doctors. That's a whole complicated and a whole nother thing. But it does seem like the system is exploiting people in their moment of need. And, you know, people aren't there's a word for it. It's duress or extortion. I mean, these are legal frameworks where you threaten people with violence to get them to do something, or when someone's under duress, they lose the ability to make a choice. So you can legally sometimes get these things invalidated. But I mean, it's like a whole nation of people under being extorted and under duress. And so, yeah. there's the agency, I think, is lost a lot of times. I mean, I feel like that as a kid. You know, that I didn't have agency. They just said you have to go to college, you know, and sign on the dotted line, and that's what you. There's no alternative. And if you don't do that, then it's going to be big bad news, you know. So there were these threats, and I, you know, of course, I didn't have the sophistication that I now have, but that's just one example across the economy where you have just, you know, you take advantage of people's ignorance, let's say. And it's sad. Yeah, it's really sad. You know, it's really sad. That's why I need like a Joseph Stalin type to really come up and fight that. No, I'm just kidding. Honestly, going into that part of the world, and I'm reading Stalin's biographies, and I'm not a Stalin apologist. He killed all these people. It's horrific. He was brutal. He was a murderer. But apparently he was a true believer. Like, they've gone into the files, and they were thinking they would discover like a background motive. But apparently all of the documents, everything, these guys were talking about the same thing they talked about publicly. We need to go after capitalists. We need to make this economy. Like, they were really true believers in the war against kind of Western style capitalism. And they had brutal and evil means to fight that battle. But I mean, this is, you know, I guess if we're talking about different styles of resistance here,
wow,
you got to add that to the list, like a militarized takeover of the system and like a brutal suppression of the capitalistic, you know, exploitation system. So, I mean, that's one thing, you know, and I've seen the fruits of that in Belarus. I mean, it really is different there, man, in terms of these issues, these particular issues of like, people don't feel, they're just going, it's like a collective and everybody's just doing their thing and everything runs. And, you know, it's not a perfect society, don't get me wrong, but it's not like this American style of like, you either die or, in America, you're either going to die or you're going to get exploited on your way to death, or you're going to somehow get lucky, you know, and strike it rich and be this, you know. And Henry Miller wrote about this. It's like the Horatio Algiers.
Yeah, Horatio Alger.
Yeah, that you can pull yourself up by the bootstraps and be a mm-hmm. massive success. You know, he called he's got a book, Air Conditioned Nightmare, when he came back from Europe in the 50s. And that was his impression. It was an air conditioned nightmare. And it was this style. He was critiquing it from this perspective of like, it's basically a lie. American dream, you got to be asleep to believe it, this kind of thing, where there's this massive threat of extinction in the American. That's how the American system seems to work. It's like this extortion and duress I was talking about earlier, but you're really there's threat to the physical body, you know, even the food and the medicine. I mean, you have to do your own research. If you just trust the food and the ads on TV about food and medicine, I mean, you're risking your life. So, anyhow, that's a little bit of a rant there, but it's just, I think there's some real, you know, I'm being maybe too hard, I don't know, on the America and Americans.
Oh, I don't know.
Okay. I mean, you guys are there in it. And I mean, do you feel like you're under threat, or do you feel like,
it's, fuck yeah. Fuck yeah. Absolutely. It's fucking stressful. I don't have an avenue either. So all of those concerns that Doug voiced about questioning whether it's my fault that I'm not as keen but I don't fit in a cat. I don't know. I probably shouldn't I probably shouldn't go on and on about it, but yeah, it's stressful. It's very stressful. I mean, I particularly worry a lot about my kids, but that's a parent thing anyways.
I don't know. Usually I just try to just keep the interest that's growing out of my head.
Yeah, I know.
I don't know. It's all a racket. It's all a scam. Like the only thing that we got super lucky and were able to buy a house in a good neighborhood when the market was at its lowest in 2008.
Yeah.
And so it just,
but going through the process of even getting a home loan is fucking scary. But
it's pretty, I mean, everything clicked into place at that point.
That's
in time.
Good though. Yeah.
And
nice.
So like what's probably going to end up happening at some point is we're just going to have to cash out and then see, I just don't know what the government's going to do. Like that's the thing. If there's so much student loan debt.
Oh, I know. Catherine Austin Fitz talks about how much global debt there is and how it's just a debt spiral. And there's just, yeah. Let alone the student loan debt. Yeah, student loan debt's crazy.
But so like, and I wasn't even like, it's funny because like just going to a normal state, you know, university, there's just certain things that are really easy for a young person to have access to. And this isn't even like the predatory lending, you know, like at a for-profit private college, say, you know, where they really are. I mean, some of those things, I just feel so bad for like people that they want opportunities. They want a good life. And they're only going to take advantage of what they can, what's before them, and they end up at some private for-profit, you know, college or trade school or something, and they rack up a bunch of student loan debt. It's just, it's kind of heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think the kids now have it a lot worse than even we had it.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
my school was cheap when I was there. Yeah.
Oh, I just realized that because I was paying like somewhere between $600 to $800 a semester.
Yeah, yeah.
And now it's closer to like $4,000 a semester.
Yeah.
Which is just nuts to me.
I went to the University of Iowa, and it was the cheapest in the Big Ten at the time, and it was SJ, you went to UT?
Texas State School and my home state school. Sounds like we all probably did something
exactly.
That.
Yeah.
So, you know, but I think the government, it'd really be interesting to see what they're going to do because it's the problem with student loans is they're not dischargeable. That's the key thing. I mean, if they were dischargeable in bankruptcy, like most debt should be, and this is what Ron Paul talks about, is that it's one thing to have a system flooded with debt, but it's another thing to eliminate the release valve that's been built into our system for like hundreds of years. So they've turned that off, and so it really is a kind of a situation where there's no way for people to get a fresh start, you know. And that used to be the whole thing: you get a fresh start, sure, there's consequences, you may have to wait.
What year did they change the bankruptcy?
It was an ongoing,
student
loan. It was an ongoing thing. It started in I think the late 70s, but the big change happened in 2005. The bankruptcy bill that Bush signed and that both parties signed, you know, and it was like a bill that made all, even the private student loans that are out there became included in the non-dischargeable category of bankruptcy. And I think it also tweaked a lot of the different, it made it a lot harder. I mean, it basically cemented that industry's, I don't know every reform in that bill, but I know it really just took everything to a whole nother level. But like I talked to my dad, I think he had a bankruptcy in the early 80s or late 70s with his student loan. And I mean, he paid it. He didn't just do a like bankruptcy, and then I think he did one where you pay eventually paid it all off. So it wasn't like he just did scot-free, I'm going to do a bankruptcy kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But apparently, you know, people were doing that. But I mean, I would rather have bankruptcies happen that may be illegitimate than have a system where you punish everybody and, you know, no one can get out. You know what I'm saying?
That's pretty nuts.
And it would be different if there was jobs. But the other thing that's happened is that the jobs have been like there hasn't been this creation of jobs, you know?
I mean, yeah.
You know, and so people are sort of locked into this. I had a job for a long time just working for an attorney that I would like do writing and research for him. And that, I mean, I felt lucky to have that, but it wasn't like a big time corporate job. It was kind of somewhere between like a slacker, like service industry job and something a little bit more serious. I felt lucky to have that, you know. I mean, and I got paid like probably somewhat more than a waiter, but I certainly wasn't getting, you know, like a corporate kind of
outside.
Exactly. But I mean, to be truth be told, I wasn't out there pounding the pavement, you know. So I don't want to say like, I tried my hardest, guys, to get that good job, and I just couldn't, you know, I wasn't trying as very hard. But I think I'm just reading the news, and it does seem like it's common that people are struggling to find jobs that pay for not only the apartment, but then the healthcare, and then, you know, their student loan or their credit card or car payment or whatever.
Yeah.
And yeah, what's going to happen, Doug? I mean, how does this... does this turn into some kind? We're just watching a documentary about China. I'm considering going to China, by the way, for a year. There's like, they have, I guess, pretty good jobs over there for English teachers. That's one thing too. I feel they talk about it. I've been reading some of the critical literature, and they talk about the advantage for native English speakers, because everybody in the world wants to speak it, and we were born with it. And so it's kind of this like economic tax, the language tax is what they call it. They have to learn it. We don't, you know. But anyhow, China, there's like this. Apparently, there's just everything's a barcode now, and you just have your QR code. That's how you pay for everything, and all of the transactions are on Alipay or these like services, pay services that are integrated into your chat application. And so, like the cash, it's basically becoming more and more eliminated. And I think that's part of whatever dystopia we're heading into. That's part of it, is that they just take out. Talk about a middleman. It's like your creditor becomes the middleman, and there's no way to avoid them because everything's in a digital payment system that the government and the creditors will have access to.
Yeah.
This documentary, one guy said he had a facial recognition camera caught him jaywalking. And within, like he said, I think a minute, he looked at his phone and they had deducted the fine from his Alipay account.
That's I've heard about this. In China, correct?
Yeah, in China. He was in Shenzhen, China. Yeah, it was like this instantaneous deduction of a fine. And amazing. So this is the kind of thing where, like, you know, what's going to happen? Well, maybe everybody's just going to get their credits, and, you know, it's just these deductions will happen. And maybe that's better, to just get it all off the top, out of the way. And then you get what's left, and you kind of, maybe there'll be a black market economy that's built around the money that people actually have, you know, opposed to these, you know, like what happened with housing is that the hedge funds bought all the houses after the crash. And so that whole crash in the economy allowed the housing market to get owned by basically landlords. And it's complicated. We'd have to study that, maybe really go into it. But I think that that was part of the scam too, was that you took the ability away from people to, get the rent, you know, get the houses. You guys are lucky. Sounds like you're able to buy a house. But a lot of people, I think, are struggling with that component too. Like, I know my cousin's got a lot of student loan debt, and he tried to get a house, and they just said, listen, we ran the numbers, and you will not be able to get one. You're out of that. You're cut out of that. You know?
Yeah.
There's this brief window of time where they don't count it as debt yet, and somehow, I don't know. Like, because I think we were still, when you're still students, they don't count it as debt. But that doesn't sound right, because I graduated in 2007, so I don't understand. We bought the house in 2010. The stars were aligned.
Yeah, just run with it, Doug. Don't ask questions.
Yeah. All right, well, it's midnight here, but it's been a good talk. I think I'm... You know what you reminded me of, SJ, is the movie Brazil. Have you ever seen that one? Like, we're entering
that. I love that movie. That's one of my all-time favorites. Yeah.
Maybe we should watch that again. I saw it 20 years ago.
Always love rewatching that. Yeah, I would do that again.
All right, we'll continue our conversation about Sorry to Bother You and bring in Brazil the next time.
Cool.
Yeah.
Maybe something else too. I'll watch a few movies to get ready for something like this. So if there's another one we can think about and email, maybe someone else wants to join and they have a movie they want.
And sorry to hear that. It doesn't look like your road will lead to the Quixote.
Yeah, it's I'm sorry too. There's okay, a movie. I saw a in a stall here. They have it right over here in Batumi. There's a coffee shop with a bookstore, and they have a Cliff Notes because it's for people learning English. And all these books, and it's like a little thin, like 50 page, like the Don Quixote for third graders. So I thought about getting that, reading it, and just pretending like I read it.
Yeah, do that. That's awesome.
I support that. It's like Moby Dick, where it's more than just the plot. Like you're in this book for a long time, and you're just kind of inhabiting the space.
But
anyway, I'll let you start your... What time is it now, SJ?
It's 11, so yeah, I'm going to go walk to the beach and maybe go see what I can get into out there.
Hey, SJ, did you ever see Inherent Vice, the movie?
I did. I saw it in the theater twice. Yeah.
Okay, nice. Yeah. I've probably watched that movie more than any movie in the last couple of years. I really like it. All right, shut up. Let's take you guys in the wrong direction. But...
All right, well, I always enjoy talking to you guys. You guys have a good night.
Morning. Yeah, you too, Doug.
All right. All right, you too, Doug. Thanks a lot. All right, peace, guys.
Take care. Good to hear your voice, SJ. See you, buddy.
Likewise. Yes. Bye, Doug.
Bye.
Oh, yeah. All right. Hell yeah. That's Titus. Oh, yeah. Don't get shit poppin' like Percocet. Got pent up, anger ain't surfaced yet. Two-steppin' like the boss, this person check. Imagine it's him as hand grenade. Asphalt, sheetrock, serenade. Jack and coke is a marinade. But we sober up quick at the barricades. Joint in my mouth, pacify. Everything out their mouth is pacified. I'm not preaching, ask why. The green one, the red one, master why. Capital camouflage with fashion. Passing the shell toes on the assassin. Dashing security at all expense.